Hello and welcome to episode 176 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk filmmaking from indie film to studio films and everything in between. How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to F it up in our very, very humble opinion. Today, I am delighted to welcome two hosts that I have with me today. One is the fantastic director, writer, and producer, Robbie McCain. Hello, buddy.
Hello, Jazz. How's it going?
Very good. Very good. I just love the way you just sink into your deep vocals. It's like some sort of sexy
It's my
bath.
Radio voice, yeah.
And also joining us as our second host today is a fantastic producer, Lucinda Rhodes-Takra. Hello, Lucinda.
Hi, Giles. I'm not going to do a sexy voice because I can't compete with Robbie McCain.
You just did it. You just did it, unbelievably, without meaning to. And did you notice there I pronounced your surname correctly?
Well, it did take a while. Eventually, you've got it right. Thank you. I appreciate your time and effort with that.
Sometimes you've just got to put a little bit of time and effort into things, haven't you? So as most of you know, myself and Lucinda made the feature film Arthur and Merlin Knights of Camelot, which was on the podcast 2 episodes ago, right? The mega special.
That's right.
4-hour megathon. Big long ep, but you learn how to make a feature film on that. Lucinda, did you learn how to make a feature film while you were recording that?
Oh, definitely. I learned a lot from yourself and Andy. I tell you what, I learned a lot about the deer.
Yes, because The Dare's a very important film that I haven't mentioned for a little while, have I? It's coming out in the UK in October. Do you know what I saw this week? Lionsgate, our distributors, sent me the artwork. And I went, wow, it's really cool. I thought, this is cool. Yeah.
So,
all right.
So we can talk about The Dare more if you like, or we could move on to another movie.
We could.
Any other movie.
Any other movie. And I love that you've done that. Thank you, Lucinda. For those who don't know, I'm Giles Alderson, by the way. I'll introduce myself. Welcome to the Filmmakers Podcast. Thank you for joining us. It's a very, very cool episode today. We have joining us the director, Ben Moll. Hello, buddy. How are you doing?
Hey, how are you? Congrats on the Arthur and Merlin.
Thank you very much, Ben. Thank you. Now, crossed paths.
And advance congratulations for The Dare, just to bring it right back to the film that we're all talking about here today.
Oh, Ben, do not jump on this.
I love it. I love it. Yes, The Dare is out in October. Thank you, Ben, for mentioning that. And if you're in America and Canada, you can watch it now. Talk of a sequel. Maybe. Who knows?
Great. But
there is. So, yeah. we're not talking about The Dare. We are here to talk about your brand new movie, Behind the Line, Escape to Dunkirk.
My name is Hauptsturmführer Drexler. And which one of you is familiar?
I'll fight whoever you want.
Escape.
Our obligation is to hit them not in the sports arena, where he hurts, in war.
While everyone's watching the fight, you slip out.
Sleep out. Are you crazy?
No. Because I'm going to give them a fight that they can't take their eyes off.
You will not win this bout.
How cool is that? How amazing that you've got another movie out in the space of, what, a couple of months? I mean, wow. First of all, how are you feeling about it all, Ben? What's going on in your mind right now?
It's always, you're kind of excited, aren't you, when you're a week away and you're nervous and I wake up at 3 a.m. thinking everybody, well, actually, I don't wake up thinking everybody hates it. I wake up thinking about, you know, did I leave the fridge open or am I wearing the wrong socks or something completely different that I only realize come the morning is actually probably displaced anxiety about the release. That, I don't know about other filmmakers and other people who do put their heart into anything that ever has to go out in front of the public. But in the run-up to it's like it's pulling the sheet off, isn't it? Which is going to happen on Monday.
This is going out Tuesday.
So this happened yesterday.
It's fascinating when a film comes out. We've just had it as well with Arthur and Merlin. And you've not long had it with We Go In at Dawn, which was your first movie, your debut feature film movie, right? Even though you've directed loads in the past, TV, music videos, short films, We Go In at Dawn was your debut as a feature director, correct? And writer?
Absolutely, yeah. It was my debut as a feature film director in the sense that it was a real movie. I'd done like 2-hour-long TV before, which is kind of feature length, but it wasn't. This is like a real, like, go to the cinema, watch a movie kind of movies. And it was great because I'd been wanting to do that for a while. And then hooking up with Lucinda was great because it really looked like, I'm sure you found this as you were trying to get your first films together as well. You meet a lot of producers along the way that don't always deliver everything that you hoped. And then, when I first met Lucinda, I was like, oh, is this going to be another one of those? And of course, it wasn't. Do you remember that, Lucinda, that first cup of tea we had in some hotel car park?
It was in Colchester.
It in Colchester?
It was.
Oh, it's so glamorous.
Yeah.
This is what filmmakers want to know, the glamour of making a movie. I was just in a hotel car park and we had a cup of tea in Colchester.
It's a tale as old as time.
No expense spared.
Not for you lot. This is ace.
Driven through with a lot of heart and enthusiasm rather than fancy snacks.
And cold cups of tea in car parks. Yeah, no, absolutely. Exactly. It does make sense. Well, that's filmmaking. That's indie filmmaking, especially when you've got lower budgets. It does happen. You've got to do that. And it's an incredible thing that you get through it. You think at the time, how the hell are we doing this? But you do. So let's jump back slightly before we get into both films, actually, but certainly Behind the Line. So you said there that you met Lucinda and that started the journey going there. And by the way, a hookup in America is something very different to what it is in the UK. I've made this mistake in the past. So just to be clear, Ben and Lucinda just met up to talk about films. I've made that mistake big time in the past. Yeah, should we hook up while we're there? Uh-oh. So anyway, look, so I suppose we wanted to talk about your journey, Ben, and your journey to meeting Lucinda and all that time, because I know you've been trying to make features for quite a while.
Yeah.
And that sort of disappointment and that heartbreak, as the same as myself, it was 8 years of full-on pain and, you know, whatever else that goes with that while you're trying to make a feature. What was your journey? What was your situation of you trying to make features and, like you said, they're meeting the wrong kind of producers?
I'll tell you what happened with me, but any of your listeners who are trying to follow along paths, you've got to be really clear about this. Every single path is different. I've never met any route into this business that you can follow. You can learn from, especially from mistakes, and you can learn from what other people have done, but there isn't a kind of a direct ladder like there is in some careers that, well, if I do this, then that'll happen. If I do this, that'll happen. So my story is my story, but it's pretty unique. I started in short form, in commercials and promos and that type of thing. Mm. I'd always wanted to do stories, but I kind of, like so many things in this life and in this business, you kind of fall into it because you get offered work. So you do one and you do a good job. So somebody offers you another one. So you do a good job of that. And suddenly 2 years have gone by and you've got a great body of work, but you haven't necessarily, you're not necessarily doing what you dreamed you were doing as a kid. Mm-hmm. So I got out of there completely, burnt all my bridges, called everybody up and said, I'm not doing commercials and promos anymore. My income died, of course.
Wow.
I literally went from like take two, a zero off it, if not two. It was insane. And I retrained as an editor and learned how to tell long form stories. My plan was, of course, to get in the room with producers. And I thought, well, editors can get in the room with producers. So I would meet them. And so I did that. And then, funny enough, it was the commercials that I'd done got me my first real directing, long form directing thing was... A guy rang me up and said, we want someone to go and shoot a documentary in Greece, but it's got to look amazing and we've got a big budget. So we wanted someone with a commercials background and he'd work with me as an editor. So everything kind of came together. So in that sense, there was a bit of planning, I suppose. So I went over to Greece and did some documentaries. And then I got kind of stuck in stuck's the wrong word. I had a fantastic time. I've been all over the world. I've done some amazing things that have been seen by millions of people, and I've had a great time doing it. So, but I ended up doing that for about 10 years. But really what I wanted to do was scripted fiction. And that was where I wanted to go.
That was your passion, that's where,
Yeah, exactly. And in spite of being in the most incredible situations and meeting some incredible people and building a nice career and having a great, you know, meeting and working with some of the best in the business, still this thing just taps away. It niggles at you. You want to do it. You can't. It's an itch you can't scratch. You want to get it away.
It doesn't matter how many books you read. Doesn't matter how many behind the scenes you watch. You still got that feeling of, I want that, but I don't know how to achieve it. It's really difficult, isn't it?
Exactly. And especially as you kind of, once you, if you can get into a genre, like in my case, it was documentaries. And if you're doing well at it, it's quite hard to turn that down and say, no, I'm going to go take 6 months away and write a spec script that no one's going to buy. But totally. You have to do it.
Yeah.
So that is actually what I did. I just quit again, the second big quit, and learned how to write screenplays. So I took a couple of years doing that, took some courses. My income again took a massive dive. It's because who's going to buy a first time? Well, there are a lot more first time scripts written than get bought, as everybody knows.
Definitely.
And so I wrote several scripts. I managed to sell a couple. Actually, I did get lucky. So I managed to sell a couple that I wasn't going to direct because they didn't feel like they were ready for me.
And how did you do that? Sorry to jump in here, but then, because I think it's really interesting for our listeners to know there's loads of screenwriters out there, filmmakers who are going, well, I've got scripts, I'd love to sell them. What was your process there? How did you actually get it to people?
So my first, the thing that that really lit that touch paper was I entered one of these 48-hour film challenges. Mm-hmm. And this is something that anybody can do. Literally anyone can do this. The prize for winning this contest was you get to pitch to all the big, a bunch of big producers and distributors. Gareth Edwards, who then went on to make a couple of films, had won it a couple of years ago. So I thought, well, he got Monster kind of out of that. So I'm going to try the same thing.
Yeah, he went on to do Star Wars just
by the way. For Star Wars and Godzilla and all kinds of movies. So I thought, well, if he could do... Yeah, actually, I said at the beginning, I think, don't follow other people's paths because it won't work out. I saw Gareth Edwards, like, right, exactly what I'm going to do. So I entered the same competition and it was Vertigo again and they were the prize people I won it with the short and we won that and it was all great. And the prize was to pitch to a panel of pretty big producers. And so I had spent ages working up my pitches and I went in, I had my 10 minutes. I pitched like hell and I could see they hated it. They absolutely hated what I was pitching. And at the end of it, literally, they hated it. They were just asleep, looking at their phones, picking their hair, dreaming of other things. You could see that. And then I got to the end, and the guy said, well, you got like 2 or 3 minutes left. What else have you got? I had nothing else. So I literally made something up on the spot. And I said, okay, I've got this thing where they're like gladiators, but they're GM people, and they're going to fight each other. And suddenly, you could just see this whole panel.
Phones
went down. They started to listen. Got to the end of it. Said, "Great, yeah, I'd love to see it. Send it to me as soon as you can." I'm like, "Fuck! I now got to write this."
It happens like that, though. It really does. You know, somebody says, "I need something."
That's kind of how this worked with the war film 3 years later. But so anyway, I wrote it, and they optioned it, and they bought it, and now it's actually happening. So that's great. So that's
fantastic. Can you say what that is?
That was it's called The Arena. And it's amazing. With Wild Seed Studios bought it in the end, who have a thing with DRG and with Netflix. So to finish that story quickly, they, after a couple of years of development on the movie, they switched it to a TV box set because they thought the returns would be better, so we'd get more, et cetera.
And you're like, whatever, listen, you get... Getting paid, you're like, I'm happy, you know, to be a paid writer from a spec script is just, it's really impressive. It just doesn't happen very often. Yeah.
So that was great. And then I met some other, because of that, I managed to get a few other options made and even a little commission for a screenplay. And then met Lucinda. We kind of hung out. We became friends. And then we ended up at the Berlin Film Festival together.
Yeah, but wait. No, you missed something.
Oh, what did I miss?
You came and worked with us on Robin Hood.
Oh, God, yes, we did. Yeah, that's how we met.
So, oh, you met on Robin Hood. Okay.
So we had the cold cup of coffee in the hotel car park. And that's when I asked Ben to come and do a few pickup days on Robin Hood the Rebellion. And we had a big green screen set up. And that's how we met, Ben. I'm really pleased that it was memorable.
This happens to you a lot, Lucinda. And this is, so you just came and did second unit, basically. You just pick up some Robin Hood and Rebellion. How great that you'd forgotten that you'd done that.
We did, yeah. We did pickups. And I think I did some VFX on it as well, didn't I? I could help put people in connection with other people.
He was supervising for us on Robin Hood.
I see. Yeah, you're
and
a fixer.
Also shooting for VFX. That's a whole discipline in itself.
I tell you something else, actually, that really did help in that regard of that, even though that my documentary career, which was great, wasn't doing scripted. We were working at budgets where we got to learn a lot of stuff that you wouldn't get to do doing short films. Or you probably even wouldn't get to do doing, you know, EastEnders and Casualty and that kind of entry level TV continuing drama. So actually, when the time came to do features now, those connections that I'd made doing those documentaries, bringing them into the feature world is great, because then you're asking favors for people, because usually in independent film, you're asking for favors, but you're asking for favors of people you've actually paid pretty well in the past. So they're more willing to come back and give you a hand. So there are a lot of sort of hidden benefits to coming to it a bit later, let's say.
I agree with that. Yeah, mine was the same route as yours, really, in that sense. And, you know, by then you'd work with a lot of people on music videos and promos where you have paid people. And then it is easier when you're doing a feature to go, look, will you come and do me a favor? It's a feature. People like feature credits and all that. And they trust you by that point.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important word in this industry is trust. You know, the fact that you've worked with Lucinda twice and a third time coming up, it looks like. And me and Lucinda have worked together lots. I mean, Robbie have worked together lots. It's that trust thing that you build up over time. And then you go, you know what people's strengths are, and you can then carry on making films that way. I think it's so important.
I also think you enjoy it. You know, if you've had a good experience, you know, it's cold, it's wet early in the morning, it's raining, things aren't going your way.
And this wasn't just in the car park in Colchester. Yeah.
The coffee's fucking freezing, you know. And and if you've done that with people who you've had good times with before, it's good to come back with. So...
yeah, and we all go through, you know, there's always issues on set. There just is. People are going to fall out. Different departments are going to clash. You're going to clash. There's loads of things can go wrong on a film set. Mm. But at the end of the day, you all want what's best for the film. That's why you're clashing, because you want to do a good job. So therefore, those things get forgotten about very quickly because everyone's happy to do the work and get on with it. And you stick with those people because it's like you say, it can be so amazing making feature films. It can be so hard, but it's also... I think one of the best things in the world.
It's amazing. People always say to me, they go, what would you do if you weren't in filmmaking? And I was like, well, I wouldn't do anything because I've never done anything else. There isn't anything, in my opinion, that is better. When you're standing on set with the cold coffee, with a load of people that you trust, no one's dropping the ball, you're working like a family, really slogging it out to make something that you believe will be absolutely wonderful. It's an amazing experience. And when you get to the end and you all have your virtual screenings or your drive-ins or, you know, soon real
hopefully
life cinemas,
premieres,
it's so lovely to look at the people next to you and go, wow, we did that. That's great. You know, it was a real experience.
Yeah, it is. And speaking of, you mentioned there, you've sort of not done anything else, but you've like been in movies since you were like 14, right? Mm. You've made TV and film since you were that age. So you literally have done nothing else. You haven't even worked as a waiter or in the bar the rest of us.
I tried it once. I went to work at Pizza Hut once and I got the sack after like 3 hours. So I knew it was not my calling. But yeah, I've grown up on set. You're laughing at me.
What did you do?
I think I just...
Did you start singing or something?
No, I was tap dancing around the salad bar. No, I just... I think they knew it wasn't for me. Yeah, mm-hmm. It wasn't.
Yeah, it didn't have the face for it. Yeah, fair enough. So, let's look. I mean, it's a fascinating journey. I think filmmaking is one of these things that is, and there's so many people who come to our events and come listen to the podcast who are going, look, I want to make a feature. How do I get that first one done? So by then you'd done lots of TV movies, and the Michael Jackson thing's really interesting, and be interesting to talk about that. The Man in the Mirror, which is a TV movie, and then you did See No Evil on TV, and The Last Days of, you know, all these type of things that are, that can only make you a better director. Now, I wanted to ask you this. Do you think that's the case? Are you glad you made all these things before you made your first feature?
I think it's a great question. I think at every stage in your life, you should probably take that jump one step earlier than you did. I always think you learn as you go through life, whether it's like learning to ride a bike and taking off the stabilizer wheels, the training wheels, or not. You should always try and just take those training wheels off one step earlier than you did. So, of course, I'm grateful that I had that career and made those shows before. And but I think my advice to anyone who's in any of these steps along a way is take a jump before you think you're ready, rather than wait till you're ready, because that's what I think you got to do. And I think it makes you braver, and don't be afraid to crash and burn.
I love that advice. It's
that's
so
great
true.
Advice.
Yeah, don't be afraid to crash and burn, because it's so easy to, you know, wait for the big money or wait for the right project. No, just go out and shoot something on your iPhone. Go out and find a DP, find a scriptwriter, and go shoot. I love that advice. Be prepared to fail. It's all right. You learn from that failure. And then someone like Lucinda goes, well, they've made a feature. Now I trust that they've been through that whole process. Now imagine what we can do with us lot helping. And it's true. It does make a big difference, actually. I agree. But people are very scared of failure. I understand it, but at the same time, you've got to be brave in this world.
That part of it doesn't go away, though. You're still scared of the failure.
Oh, God, yeah.
All the way along. It's just you'd somehow learn to sleep.
Do you know what, Ben? Ben says something. Ben says, we have conversations, Ben and I, a lot about, you know, should we do a movie at this budget or that budget? Who can we use? And Ben goes, just say yes to everything and worry about it later.
Great.
Literally.
Yeah.
And now I've just taken that. I'm like, great.
And it's so true. And then you get to the point where you go, oh, now we need to worry about that.
Yeah. We're in it now.
But that's okay. We're in it now. But that's right. It's better than not being in it, right? I think so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Totally. What's it? The yes man, isn't it? How much has life changed when you started saying yes to things? And, you know, it's, I'm not saying you say yes to everything, but I'm saying you think about what you want to do and work it out later. That's good advice. It really is. Speaking of which, Ben, the first time I heard of you was a short film called 10 Minutes that you directed.
Oh, wow.
For Dean Fisher.
Yeah,
it's going back, because Dean Fisher was on the podcast last week. Break run last week, weren't they, talking about that film? And obviously Dean produced the first movie I ever was the lead in as an actor. And it's just really interesting connecting those dots, because we talked about you last week a tiny bit. And then we, talking with you now about this. But yeah, that's when I first heard of you in that. And you had Nick Moran in that, Terry Dwyer.
Craig Charles. We had Craig Charles at his thing. That was... Dean's great, and good luck with Dean, and congratulations to everyone involved in Break this year. That's going to be a really good thing for all of them, and it's a great film. In fact, when we get on to talking about the war film, I was at a cast and crew test screening of Break when I saw Sam Gittins, and that's when I said, right, we're going to bring him into our film. So that was kind of all thanks to Dean, in fact. But I just want to say one quick thing about that, and you and me. I have been to your sessions before. You're just way too busy to say hello to everyone.
It's too big time.
too big time. Yeah, sorry about that. I normally do. I spend a lot of time talking to it. I try and speak to everyone. And I remember one of the events recently, I just happened to be stood by the door. I was trying to go out for a piss, I think, just before the Make Your Film event. And everyone started coming in. Someone had let them all in. So I was now stood by the door and I started shaking people's hands. And I ended up shaking everyone's hand who was coming in, as if I was greeting everyone.
It's like Willy Wonka.
Willy Wonka is. I apologize, because normally, I'm sure, maybe did we say hello? Did we at least say hello?
Yeah.
Oh, well,
but
fine.
It's all good. I shook your hand and went with everyone else that day.
Oh, so that was you? You would say, right, well, okay, that was a...
The thing with Dean is great. You always keep your friends, because it's a small business and it's going to come around. And you're going to... end up, if not working with, working like one step removed from these people for, you know, for years and years. And that the thing with Nick Moran and Craig Charles and Terry Dwyer of Break, that's where they met, actually.
Yes, it was.
In fact, so I introduced Dean to Terry Dwyer, which is how Break happened. So there we go.
Correct. That's that. So actually, Break only got made because of you.
So it's, yeah, it's my fault.
I'm surprised you haven't banged on the door for a massive credit and money in back end and stuff. It is interesting though how fascinating the whole indie film world is, and especially doing this podcast. I've met so many people in this industry who are making indie films, and you realize how close everyone is and how connected. And if they're not, and if they are a little bit separate, then they stay separate. But we all talk, we all are in the same world, we're all trying to make indie films, and we're all trying to support each other. You know, that's what this podcast is about, support. And the fact that you said there how, you know, you do stay close to these people, you know, one step removed at times, but you know you can contact them if you've got a problem or if you want to help or if you're... That's huge in this industry, and I recommend it to anyone listening to do that, to be always be available to help. Sometimes you might not want to, or it might be difficult, but these people go on in this business, and we make films, and you want to be around the people who are making films. So, you know, don't be afraid to send an email or send a tweet or retweet their stuff constantly. It doesn't hurt. I know I've cast people, obviously they came in and were very good, but because they always retweet my stuff, and I was like, who is this person?
Yeah,
and
you
then
do.
When the casting came up, you go, oh, right, that. Or if it's a crew member or whatever, you see them.
I tell you what, that's what we did with Jen Martin. So just actually to tie us all in, moving on to Behind the Line when you're ready, obviously, is Jen came in to read... for Arthur and Merlin, but she was reading in for the people that were auditioning. And when we were casting Behind the Line, I said to Ben, she was great. She really helped Giles and I out. She didn't have to. She probably got a cup of coffee for it and that was it. And she gave up her whole day. We didn't know her from anyone. And she, so that's why I went to her first.
And we found she was on Twitter, right? You asked to put a tweet out, right? I want someone to come and help read in with the actors. And now she got, you know, I'd say the lead female role in Behind the Line. You know, and I mean, obviously she auditioned was very good, but still.
But that's the thing as well. You don't get work by doing that. You still have to be good.
Yes,
of course. It gets you in the room, you know, and that's part of the journey. It's part
being in
of
the room is the most important thing. It's the thing I tell actors all the time. It's all about getting in that room. Whatever your showreel's like, whatever your tape is like, get in the room. Make sure you get in the room. Make sure they want to see you. Show them something that is different or intriguing. Get in the room. Because once you're in the room, then it's yours to win. And that's so important. Same with crew. Same thing. Yeah. It makes a difference. If DPs are sending me stuff all the time, I'm taking notice, writing it down. You know, I've got great DPs, but... what happens if they're not available or someone else rings me up about a project and says, hey, I need a DP. I've only got this much. Well, actually, try these people. So it's so important in this industry to be around and be noticed. Get your stuff out there. And that is perfect lead us on to Behind the Line. I really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was really well made. I really felt the performances were fantastic. It was shot beautifully, really interesting, and a great story. So, you know, well done, Ben. I thought it was really well done. And Lucinda as well for doing this. So let's talk about how it came about in terms of why Behind the Line, why make another war film? Why do this story? Let's just how it first started for the two of you.
Goes back to Berlin, right, Lucinda?
Yeah, so
we're back there.
So Ben and I, we've got a few projects together that we're developing, and we said, right, well, we need to go to Berlin, go to the European film market. So we did, and we went over there to pitch a few projects, and I was in contact for a long time with Andy Taylor at 101 Films and Steve Daly there, Davey there, and they said, oh, look, it's now time to partner up and do a movie together. And we had a finance partner on board with 101. And I said, okay, well, what do you want? You know, we've got lots of different films. We're developing this genre, that genre, you know, World War II we'd like to do. They went, that's it. We're going to do a World War II movie. And Ben and I were still going around thinking about, you know, the concept for the film. So we didn't actually have anything on paper for it. So we went back that evening, had dinner, had a couple of bottles of wine, and then Ben came up with the wonderful concept. We went back at 8:30 the next morning to have a meeting, and he pitched, and it was signed, sealed, delivered. That was it. And then a few weeks later, I'm going through the contracts, and I said, look, if we're going to do one, why don't we do two? And that's when I went back to Ben and said, do you fancy doing two? He said, just say yes and we'll worry about it later.
So there you go.
I said, okay, fine, let's do two. So we negotiated and we decided to shoot two very different war movies back to back with one day off in between. So it was kind of, Sam Gittins, our lead, came on set the first day and he said, normally everyone's a bit nervous, they're getting to know each other. But he said, I walked into this already moving machine. So we actually shot it like a TV series where you would have the same crew, but cast coming in. So you're already moving the whole time. Mm-hmm. So we looked at it like that. Just, they were two different, in my mind for certain, Ben, you can correct me. I saw it as two different episodes. So that's how I got through it and managing the different stories and cast. Because it was, you know, brain frying to do two at once. Different locations, different cast, different costumes, all different contracts, you know, line producing two different films. It was chaos because at one point we were going to do one movie in the morning, one movie in the afternoon if we needed to use, because we had some actors in both. For instance, Tim Berrington was in both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ryan Winsley as well, right?
Ryan was in both, yeah.
Yeah. But, and Guy Fawkner, yeah, a few.
Antonio was in both, yeah. So it was, there you go. So we shot two back to back. But
looking at it now, because shooting one movie is tough. Shooting two movies almost back to back with one day off must have been pretty taxing on the brain and difficult. I can only imagine. Would it be something, you know, you would agree with? And would you do that again? Back to back, because it's kind of crazy. It's really like, wow, all right.
So getting the opportunity to make a film is amazing. So take it, right? Don't look that particular gift horse in the mouth. However, if I was running my world from some kind of puppet master place in the sky, I probably wouldn't do two movies back to back again. Even though I'm hugely loved the experience of doing it, mm-hmm. and I think they are distinct, and I think they both have separate, they're very, very different films, and it didn't just become some sort of blurry long mess of two movies. They work incredibly different, not just in their stories and casting, obviously, but in their soul and attitude and the rest of it. We're different enough that we could. It was fairly easy to switch mentally and emotionally between the two worlds because they were, one's kind of like a throwback 60s Saturday matinee kind of film. And the one with Sam, the one we're talking about today, is much more a kind of action lads film. So it was quite easy to move around them emotionally and mentally. But it's just tiring. And at this budget, when everybody's doing two or three jobs and the hours are long and you finish a 12-hour day and you've still got to go and figure out how to redo tomorrow's call sheet because you've dropped a lot of shots because of the rain or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's difficult to do it all again when you just finished one.
I can imagine. And how many days did you shoot We Go In At Dawn for, which was your 60s style, you know, throwback
to that? I think that was 12, was it? Or what was
that? Was 11.
11
days for your first one. One day off. Oh my God, that one day must have been mental because you're preparing for the next film anyway, not let alone trying
absolutely
to sleep. And then behind the line was how many days?
11
days again. I think, well done, first of all, because there's so much going on when you're making a film. There's so many questions. And my question too is, how did you prepare behind the line while you were shooting another movie? Because I don't know how you'd have done that.
So that was okay, actually. I got to say that bit
really?
Was fine. Yeah, and I'd done kind of 5-week, 6-week shoots before. So keeping that amount of I've done like two episodes of a TV show back. I've done that length of production before. So keeping that amount in my head and in my an emotional connection to that stuff was okay, even when you're tired. What I would say, though, and here's where it gets really difficult, is as you know, Giles, and everyone on this podcast and most of our listeners will know, in making a film, what you plan to do that day, if nothing goes wrong, you can get it done. That's otherwise you're an idiot, right? That's the way you work. But things go wrong every day. So from like, if you call at 9, by 10:30, you're chasing something that's got wrong. And if you're doing working for 4 or 5 weeks, kind of with hardly a day off and no thinking space, you have to make decisions about when to stop and drop a scene because you're running out of time, or not do another take on a performance because it wasn't quite there, or it was. I mean, we got lucky, we had a great cast. That gets really tiring. So that's the really difficult bit, is knowing that you're working so intensely and quickly.
So why don't you give us a little pitch on what Behind the Line is about, and we'll jump deep into it.
So World War II was really about citizen soldiers. It was about regular people going into a horrific situation and having to make horrific choices. And against the backdrop of everybody, of the horrific things that were happening all over the world at the time, regular people were called upon to be heroes, but they weren't heroes. So it became like, what's a hero mean? And what really is that? There's even a line in the movie where someone says, look, we're just soldiers. We're not heroes. We're here to do a job. We're not here to be a Superman. That kind of gets you to a what would I do feeling in the audience, which I think audiences respond to. I certainly do when I'm watching. Also on top of that, I quite like war movies and action movies to throw in some tropes and homages and hit some of those genre beats quite squarely on the nose with a kind of a knowing, like, we know we're doing that. We know this is a bit that you're going to like if you like a war movie. And to be a bit playful with that whilst keeping it real, I thought was also something we really wanted to do. So we came up with this story about a couple of kids who get taken prisoner by the Nazis, and they get together with a bunch of other prisoners and stage a boxing match in order to stage an escape.
It's really cool. So let's talk about the actual making of it then. Did you know early on how much budget you'd have when you were speaking to Warner One? Was it a case of they said to both of you, yeah, okay, well, this is how much you can have for this movie and this is how much you can have for this movie? Or was it a moving beast early on when you especially didn't know what price it would be or project it would be?
Well, I mean, budgets are always a further conversation. They're always talking about, it depends on, so you have a working top sheet or you have the working budget, but there always needs a discussion as you move forward. You may, like, for instance, we didn't have that boxing ring. Because obviously having a boxing ring is quite expensive, especially a period one. And in the end, we had to go back and work the budget and say, okay, well, we need a little bit more, but we're going to have to take it for somewhere else. So budget conversations are ongoing the whole time, and they can move from hour to hour sometimes, can't they, Ben? Because you have to beg, borrow and steal from different departments to make it work without going so over budget or so far that the people don't make their return. So the investors don't get return on their investment, and they don't want to spend loads of money because they know how much they can make. So we have to be very, very careful.
Budgets are really strange things because actually films don't have a budget. It's not like a sports car is more expensive than a cheap car because the work that's gone into the sports car. The budget affects how you make the film more than what the film is. You can make a film with your friends and an iPhone for, you know, £100, you could make that same film for millions if it was a more expensive camera and Tom Cruise and Benedict Cumberbatch or somebody. Do you know what I mean? So it's budgets can be, they're a little bit misleading, deceiving, I think, and deceiving. Yeah, because sometimes a film can be made for, the budget really is an expression of how that film got made rather than specifically what it is, I think. And Lucinda worked her ass off to get as much as she could, which was amazing. And, you know, but you do never have enough ever. But at the same time, we made a film. So it got made at the budget that Lucinda got. And so that is that's a great bit of producing. In fact, that's what half of what producing is, making great films at the budget that they're given.
Exactly that. Exactly right. And was both budgets the same for We Go In at Dawn and Behind the Line, the same amount?
It's
a little bit
Didn't we have a whole pot?
We had one budget that we managed over two films.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay. So they said, hey, look, here's X amount. You go, if you want to make two films, that's totally up to you. You work out how much it's going to be.
Because we got the budget raised by saying, let's do two.
Got you. I see. That's clever.
But then we had the problem of making an increased budget work over two films. Behind the Line on paper was probably a little bit more. Not by a lot, you know, but a little bit more because of the different sets, the volume of cast. We really only had three leads in We Go In At Dawn. Behind the Line was, I mean, we had all the POWs, we had our villains, we had the big lighting rigs. Our cinematographer, Pete Alaboni, brought some of his guys up from London because we shot the whole thing in Suffolk, where we are based, Picture Perfect. And Pete Alaboni, we were there 2-3 in the morning when some of the London guys had finished on a big movie, drove all the kits to Suffolk, rigged it up, then left. It was, I mean, it was amazing, the setups that we had for Behind the Line, where it was a little bit more basic on We Go In At Dawn.
It's an incredible achievement, what you've done. I really enjoyed Behind the Line. I'm not saying that. I thought it was really a really interesting, well-made movie with great shots and great performances. It really is a great movie, really cool. Let's go into, you know, the making of it then for you, Ben and Lucinda. How from that moment when you got the green light, which must have felt amazing, Ben, and also that suddenly you go, oh, pressure or whatever it was, how do we do this? Now you've got to write two scripts, for one, but also is the actual making of it itself. First of all, was that whole process of, right, we've got the money, now go write it. Was that okay for you? Was that like water off a duck's back? It's like, finally, about time.
Because, Ben, you wrote both films in 2 months.
Yeah, I think anyone who says writing's easy is probably lying. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know anybody, and I know some pretty successful writers who I don't think anyone would say that. So it wasn't. No, it's hell. It's one of the hardest things in the world to come up with good stuff by yourself that no one else has come up with on your own. It's like,
it's impossible.
I think it's the hardest part of the. I find it anyway one of the hardest parts of the process. So no, that was scary, and that was it was good. I was lucky I had taken quite a bit of time out, and I really recommend this to everybody, by the way, to do some courses and do some training like 4 or 5 years ago and really learn how to write and practice. And I'd written sort of 10 specs that haven't got anywhere, that nobody, people have read and given feedback on. And some of them have got, you know, a couple of steps in and then got rejected. So you learn a lot from all your rejections. So keep writing, basically. Just write. Because one day you're going to end up in mine and Lucinda's situation where someone says you got to write 2 in 6 weeks. And then those 10, that's easier if you've done a whole bunch, even if no one's ever made them or bought them. I'm sure you agree with that.
Yeah, totally, totally. And what's your writing process? Do you have notes around? Obviously, if it's a World War II movie or two of them, you've got to research that. You've got to, you know, get the ins and outs and get the technology right and the wording and details. Yeah. How did you go about that?
So I'd do a lot of research. Sam's characters actually ended up being based on a real person. The scene that happened in real life with this particular real individual got cut from the final script, actually, which is a shame because that means that's not really based on him. But originally in the research, it was based on this private who was a boxer, who did get captured by the Nazis in the first couple of weeks of the war. And it was really based on him from a South London boxer. But writing-wise, I write from very inside out. So I'll write one line, then one page, then two pages, always the whole story from beginning to end, expanding that as I go. So my final treatments are usually 60, 70 pages long, but without any dialogue.
Yeah, and then I'll write the script. That's a really good way to do it. Yeah, it's a good way to do it.
Rather than start at the beginning.
Totally, because you can get lost that way. I've done that in the past. And hey, everyone's different. You know, Christy Wilson Cairns has got her own opinion, you know, writing 1917 and whatnot.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm like you. I have to put in the biggest treatment I can and keep expanding that treatment.
Exactly.
And showing it to people and what's right, what's wrong. Because otherwise you can get lost. You start writing and then you get to page 70 and you go, oh my God, I haven't even got to the, you know, first inciting incident yet.
Yeah.
How do I redo this? So I think that's a great way to do it, especially when you had very little time and you had to just get on with it. And did the first drafts come in okay? You were like happy to get the story and just get on with it, I suppose, as a writer.
I think one of the things as well, working that way, and luckily that's the way I would have naturally worked, is I could go to Lucinda and Jeet and 101 at every stage and make sure that everybody was happy. So we were casting off a 20-page treatment, and then we were location scouting off a 30-page outline. And then we, you know, so by the time the actual script was getting finished off on the night before, you know, but everybody was involved all the way along. So they weren't like, oh, I don't understand that, or that's a surprise, or what.
Yes.
That said, you'd always want more time. Everybody does.
The actual casting of that then, obviously Sam Gittings plays your lead of Danny Finnegan. You've got, you know, we mentioned Jennifer Martin in there, Malcolm Elkins in there as well, and Ryan Winsley's and Tim Barrington's. And we even have Joel Phillimore as well, who's our Modred in Arthur and Merlin as well in there. And, you know, the rest of the cast are all really cool. What was your cast? What do you like to do in casting? What do you like to see from actors?
So that's, I had never done a whole thing off self-tapes and phone interviews before. I'd always been in the room, always. I think it's really important to be in the room with the actor. But on this one, because of the time and the money that we had, we did it all on self-tapes, which actually, with the way the world is going, might be the future. We might have that might be like the next 20 years of our, I'm not sure we're all going to be in rooms quite like we used to be. But so everything was on self-tapes. A lot of it came through connections and agents, especially from Lucinda's, because Lucinda's had, I think this is your eighth film or something, Lucinda? Ninth film, right? So yeah, there's eight time. Other movies to draw on, plus all her TV. So a lot of them came from that.
And that's what we were saying, Ben, about earlier, about these contacts and building up over time of being a filmmaker,
no doubt,
and being an actor and whatever it is. These contacts come because Lucinda liked them. Liked Lucinda. They had a connection. So when the film comes up, they go, actually, you know, Joe Egan's right for this. Jennifer Martin's right for this. Michael Elkin's right for this. It's because they've been around for a while doing their thing and being in people's faces, if you like, but not too much. So that's how it totally works.
They're also reliable and they're very professional. I've worked with Michael Elkin, huge. Ryan Winsley. I think Ryan's done like six films for us and Michael's done maybe three or four. And they're reliable. And I think Ben and myself, we trusted them to take the character in a different direction, actually. So Michael Elkin decided to put on an accent and so did Ryan, because they wanted to try new things. And because Ben and I knew them and I've worked with them before, we knew how professional they were. So we let them have their own way with the character, if you like. Obviously with guidance, but...
There's also a trade-off there. To punch above your budget weight, you have to give actors some slack. And if they say, okay, I'll do it, but if I'm allowed to do this, then you get a better actor than you might have otherwise been able to afford, because you're allowing them, they feel, you know, ownership, and they can become stakeholders in the whole creative thing. And that's, I think that's fantastic.
They become more invested.
Yeah.
Sam Newman's another example. Obviously, he's in Arthur and Merlin as well, and he's just great in the film. You know, could he actually speak German? Because
we were very, very aware of that. Actually, we needed people that were fluent French or German. We didn't want to have any mock accents. We just wanted everything as natural as possible. Sam's fluent, Tim's fluent, Jen's fluent, and that was. You've got to get that right. If not, people will. I know there's other war films that don't have anybody speaking in another language or with an accent. They've just kept it UK. And really, people are questioning. They're watching going, I'm sure they should have a German accent right now, or they should be speaking to the other Germans in German.
In German, sure. Yeah, I thought your whole cast was really great.
I got to say one thing as well about our cast. I can't praise them enough. If you're trying to shoot 8 to 9 pages a day, of action movie, if you don't have a great cast, you're screwed from day one if you don't get that. So that really saved us. And I say this all the time, but once the cameras are rolling, anything me or Lucinda or anybody else in the crew does, or all that goes out of the window. It's all about those actors in front of the camera in that moment, and if that's not right, the rest of it doesn't really matter.
So, you know, it's so true. It doesn't matter how good the camera angle is at that point, how amazing the lighting looks. If the acting's not great in that moment, no one cares. They just go, oh.
I was going to ask Ben a question, actually. It's nice for me to be able to kind of speak to my director, because we're moving at such a fast pace that we never get a chance to actually debrief and relax and go, okay, well, why were those choices? So I'm looking at quite a lot of stills at the moment from the film, and I've been putting them out on social media and things like that. And the cinematography and what Pete was able to achieve in the barn that we used was absolutely fantastic, because we had we had a lot of gaps in the roof, didn't we? So a lot of the lighting was natural. Obviously, we did have the rig above, which made that lovely spotlight for Joe and Sam Gittins. But it did help having that natural lighting as well. Did you spend a lot of time back and forth with Pete on how we wanted to light it and shoot it? What I'd like to hear about that process, because we haven't spoken about it.
Yeah, tons. I mean, I think the more talking you can do with anybody, the better. You know, you're all going to end up with your specific credit on the end of the day. So in the process, it doesn't really matter who had the idea. It's just as long as it makes for a better film. So we spend as much time as we could talking about it. It gets more dramatic towards the end, and it kind of gets more epic towards the end. And so we used these holes in the roof to have the sun kind of streaking through with smoke, and it kind of feels like these sort of heavenly rays are coming onto this fight, whereas in the earlier fights, it was much more top lit, which is much more, gives you a sort of line across your shoulders and shadows under the eyes, so you can't quite see what people are feeling. So all of that is definitely very thought out, and then scheduled through the day, of course. I think it's really important to schedule through the day, especially when, you know, we had four lights or something on the whole thing, so we're using available where we can, obviously, and the sun is much brighter than anything we could have.
But so we had to use natural lighting because of the period as well, same as what we had to use on Arthur and Merlin. Or it would
Yeah, I mean, DOPs find it, it's really difficult for DOPs to give highlights, depth highlights in period stuff, because in modern day stuff you just put a little globe light or an angle point, you know, a light in the background. But in the period, unless you've got flat fire, which you don't in every setup, you know, in Arthur and Merlin has some great lighting in it, but none of it's got, you know, shafty headlights or other sort of lighting that you would do from a non-period piece.
Totally,
it's a real challenge. Looks beautiful, by the way. I'm not just saying that because I'm on your
show. Thank you. Andrew Rogers, amazing DP. Yeah, absolutely. Looks gorgeous.
For sort of getting actors in that zone in when you're kind of faced with such strict time limitations, because obviously you're not going to have time to be doing loads and loads of takes, not that much time to do that much rehearsal. What's your strategy there on set for sort of making sure that they can really get into character?
I need to work on that. I like talking. No, I like talking. And I think everybody overdirects, no matter whoever they are.
Yeah,
and I'm guilty of it. And I think let the actor do it. Just let them do it, and then make it quicker or slower or bigger or walk to the window and say it. Even that's a bit too specific. But to avoid over-directing, I think it's great. And then redirect as you go. Of course, that's fine. Their job is to get it right in that moment. Your job is to understand how it fits within the whole. I mean, you're both trying to fit it within the whole, but you're trying to pretend to be the audience in that moment and fit it, edit it in your head with what came either side. So you can not judge them in a bad way, but kind of help them once they're going. But I think over-directing actors, I used to do it on short films and things. It never gets you anywhere. It wastes everybody's time. Mm-hmm. They know what the character's doing. They know what it is. You've spoken about that in meetings before, in the pub, over dinner. Mm-hmm. Get them in a place where they think. On the other hand, creating an atmosphere where they feel comfortable to do that, that's vital, right? So, and that could just be a touch, you know, a hey, what did you have for breakfast kind of touch. Or, you know what, you got this one. This is great. Or you're taking this a bit. I don't think you've got a better one than that. You're taking it a bit too far. Maybe you can bring that back. Rather than kind of direct people, that's how I think.
You kind it's of really interesting. You're more sort of empowering them and giving them the confidence.
Making somebody feel that they can do their best, and then they do their best. I think it's
absolutely
that's the trick. As far as I can tell,
and said there, Ben, earlier about, you know, you've on set is not the time to be discussing character arcs. This should be done way before, so that when you get to set, you can direct the details. So you can give them doing words and adjectives and verbs, things that can make a difference to their performance. Me and Lucinda have been actors for years, and when a director comes and starts talking to you and waffling on about, well, remember 7 years ago your character felt like, that means nothing in the moment right now. Do you want me to play hate, anger? What, you know, give them the doing word. Actors understand that. We know how to deal with that. You're upset with them, but don't show it. Oh, I can play that, but I can't play 7 years ago you felt upset with this person. What does that mean? That doesn't mean anything. So it's really important not to overdirect. I think that's great advice. Really good. And creating that comfortable environment, huge.
And leave, and theme, and leave all that shit at the door, you know, where this fits in the general, in the vision. I mean,
it's done. It's done. You did that ages ago. There's no point talking about it on set. Totally. Unless you haven't had time to talk to them, but then try and do it on the phone. Do it by Skype beforehand. Exactly. Do it when they're in the makeup chair. Do it then. Get it all out. And then when you're on set, when the camera's ready to roll, especially when you've got 11 days to shoot, you've just got to be on it. And everyone needs to know. And I imagine when it came to doing Behind the Line, like you said, your team were like a machine by this point. You were all just oiled. And you know, if you said, right, we're going to two shot, we're going to track along from here, and then we're going to punch in this one, we're going to punch in that. All your team knew exactly what you're doing, your props team, your camera team. It was only your new actors, exactly like Sam Gitting said. He said, oh my God, so this is great. Imagine if we could do that from the off on every movie start with.
But it takes 3 or 4 days to settle in and get that machine well oiled, actually. It does.
It does. And actually, that's a good advice to anyone who's about to make their first film or about second one. Remember that. Don't get bogged down in it. Do scenes that are easier to do. Take longer on that first day so you're not rushing to get your amazing shots, or you've got to get 10 scenes in and 103 pages on that first day. Don't do it. It's just everyone will be upset and crying, and it won't be fun for the rest of the shoot. Talking of amazing sort of props and design team, we talked about Badger earlier, but look, you know, all the stuff felt really authentic, from the costumes through to how they talk, to what they're eating, to even though they didn't eat that much, but do you know what I mean? It all felt very authentic. Did you really prep that? Did you go through that with Badger, and did you have vision boards? Did you do all that sort of stuff?
Absolutely. So even if I entering it, I didn't know we were going to have enough money for a grade, right? But even if we'd have been having millions for a grade, I still think you grade through the art department and not necessarily with the computer's there to make it better later.
Through the camera and through your art department. Absolutely.
So it's as much a part of what Giles, I mean, everyone on this podcast knows what the job is, but we all agree, right? That's part of the job, is getting that look and feel right. I'd luckily done a whole bunch of stuff with Badger before for TV.
Great. So you knew what he could do and what was right.
And I'd done a lot of kind of factual drama with Badger and drama doc stuff. So there was a shorthand there already. One of the things, different to this from, I don't know, a science fiction set 50 years in the future on a different planet, is we could look at a lot of pictures of stuff that was really there and did really happen. And I think all of that stuff, there's like the interior design of Jen's house, for example, really feels real. And I think if that feels real, people believe it. It was probably Ridley Scott or somebody, I can't even remember who, said something about if the film doesn't feel real, the audience doesn't worry for the characters. And I really sort of believe that. If it's got to feel real, and the design and the look is part of that smoke and mirrors, because obviously it's not real.
Yes.
Someone's hiding under a table holding that lamp in place or whatever it might be.
Yeah, you know it. Yeah, you know there's a smoke machine on the corner. Exactly. Just out of frame. You know that there's someone there. There's a sound guy's literally going, if I move, I'm going to be in shot. Just the magic of it.
Or their shadow is in shot, but you're like, don't move because it doesn't look like you. You're fine. Exactly.
It could be anything.
I love it. Sarush, we can see you.
Sarush again, of course. The lovely Sarush did this as well. Brilliant. So Lucin, from your side of it then, producing a movie like this, because this was, did you shoot this before Arthur and Merlin? Or
yes, we did. Yeah, we shot this last June, actually.
You've like made 5 films in 2 years, right? Or is it more?
No, 5 films in one.
5 films in one year.
So 2019, we did 5. 2020, we've done none so far.
But they're all coming out this year.
All
the press and talk.
It's been great. Exactly. It's been great, actually, having the time to enjoy the releases.
Yeah.
Where normally a film's being released and I'm shooting something. So I don't have time to actually go, oh, great, I'd like to sit back and read reviews and actually see the response from everybody else.
And just to finally to touch on the sort of the action side of this, because there is you know, there's lots of gunfire, there's deaths, there's a great boxing match, two of them. How did you shoot that? What did you, obviously I saw how you shot it, but how did you plan to shoot that, I suppose?
There's no way we could have done any of that, those boxing matches, without people who knew how to box. So that was sort of top of the, I mean, we got some wonderful actors on there, so it's great. And they really deliver emotionally, so that's also really important. But if they hadn't been technically able to box, we would never have made our days those days. I mean, that's quite difficult stuff to shoot at the best of times, let alone. But these actors were so great. They could hit each other all day long without making contact. It was a really, really saved the film, was having Sam, Paddy and Joe who could fight. And so that saved us. And then Pete had a camera. We shot this thing on a Sony camera, which is, it's really cool. It's like about the size of a large shoebox, but the front bit breaks off. So that becomes the size of, I guess the size of even smaller than a DSLR. That the cameraman can hold and carry. So he was actually in the ring, dancing around the fighters with them, holding this tiny camera, even though it was shooting like 8K on the massive, and cabled with this really thick cable, as thick as your arm, going back to the main body, that Sophie, the camera assistant's running around, trying to get it out of the way of the actor's feet so they're not tripping over. So that, I think that kept those alive. So we did pretty long takes, and there's choreographed long takes, but there's no way we could have done it if the actors hadn't been great boxers.
Yeah, that's so true, because it comes across, you know, it really does. And I knew Sam was a boxer, and obviously your German guy was a boxer, and obviously Big Joe, he can fight. Obviously, he was in Arthur and Merlin, and he did take a punch, a proper one from Richard Short, and he just took it and went, you got me there. You got me a good one. His blood streaming from his nose. It's like, wow. Yeah, pretty full on. So, yeah, I think that's really important. And had you planned your shots from, you know, did you go, right, I want to be, I'll get from that side. I know how he's going to hit the floor here. I know how I want to get inside the head. Or was it kind of organic a little bit? You know, choreographically wise.
No, that was pretty planned, I've got to say.
Good.
And we had to be, partly for safety of the actors doing the hitting each other in the ring, but also our budget didn't allow us to have, only allowed crowd in on set for one day. So we couldn't shoot any wider shots or backgrounds. So had we had the full set, we could have shot it more organically. But because we were shooting like the close-up of a punch 2 days separately to the wide shot of that same punch.
Oh, wow.
It was that sort of much of a head fuck.
That's
we had
hard.
To shoot. So there are bits in it where that are now three shots cut together. Well, not just bits, almost all the sequences are three shots cut together, wide, mid, tight, were shot on three on different days.
Wow.
Across the same action. That
oh,
was,
my gosh.
Yeah. That's a heavy storyboarding issue, also a heavy lighting issue.
Especially using natural light. Well, you don't know the mid, suddenly lights change because it's now cloudy, or the actor's hair's different, or the stance is slightly different. My god, that's difficult.
So we had to, and actually the actors were great. They would hit things. The BGs were also brilliant. Everyone was brilliant. The trickiest part in the edit was actually the referee, because I had kind of forgotten the referee. This is my bad. I was so focused on where the actors were going to be and what their faces were telling us emotionally, and where they were hitting each other for A, for plot, and B, for safety.
Yeah.
That I kind of forgot where the referee was sometimes, because I got tunnel vision about our main characters, obviously.
Of course you would. Yeah.
And then you get to the edit and he's like over on the left, then he's over on the... So that was... They were a headache.
I didn't notice. Finally then, some advice from both of you from Lucinda then to producers out there.
Pay attention to detail, because that's one of the things that the audience members, historians, are going to pick to pieces, and they will forget about the characters and the story because they're going, well, that's not a World War II spoon. That's not a World War II table. And you've lost your audience straight away. So attention to detail. And Badger was, and his team were absolutely fantastic. I remember we had our first artwork presented to us, and Stu, part of Badger's team, said, "That gun's on the wrong shoulder. It needs to be changed immediately." And I thought, great. That's why you need the right team that know exactly what they're doing with this genre.
Great advice. Ben, go for it.
Yeah, working at this budget and speed, or working on any indie film or low budget film, you are gonna, there are gonna be times when you're going too quickly, when you lose things because of other circumstances beyond your control, or it's just a really ambitious thing to do. So there is gonna be bits of it that fall by the wayside, and those really hurt. So the thing you need to find is what's gonna get you through and hopefully help make that a really good film. And I think that is always trying to remember what the heart of it is and what the, what you're trying to make people feel about the heart of what you're trying to do, so that when you do have to drop a scene because of you, it's raining, or you can't do another shot because the actor's booked to go to the, leave the set because they've got to be back in London, whatever it is, that if your heart is right, somehow you hope the audience will be carried along and forgive you for the little things along the way, because they believe that you believe in the sort of heart of the project. That's what I'm hoping our audience are going to believe in.
They will. They really will. You know, like Lucinda said there, you're always going to get people who are going to criticize and say the spoon wasn't right or this wasn't right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But as a movie and someone who isn't affected by, you know, whether the gun was on the right side or the left side, I loved the movie. I think it's brilliantly well done. I can't believe the budget you made it for. You know, a micro budget film like this, stunning. It really is. You've done brilliantly, both of you. I do believe that. I think it's great. It is. And everyone should go see this movie, Behind the Line, Escape to Dunkirk. It is available now. Check it out. This is how to make an indie film. I wish it was behind the scenes on how you made this. That would be so cool as well. But you've got this podcast. So there it is. Lucinda, where can people find you and follow you and see all these wonderful pictures you're putting out at the moment? And for all those actors and directors and producers out there who want to get into this industry and work with Lucinda, where can they find you?
So follow my social handles. Twitter is at PicPerf Limited, PicPerf Limited, LTD. And on PicPerf Movies Instagram and PicPerf Movies on Facebook. Please come and say hello. Lovely to connect with new people, and maybe we can work together sometime.
Gorgeous. Ben?
With my name, Ben Mole, you could just search it and it'll come up. I've got a website, benmole.com. I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, all with Ben Mole. So there aren't that many of us. Come find me and me ideas.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, we all want the next one, right?
It's true.
I like
we
want that next in the background, Ben, by the way. Is that looks like it's for ideas and coming up with them as well.
Hold on a minute, Robbie. Robbie, I've got all our DVDs here at the back and you haven't even noticed them, but you notice a whiteboard.
Yeah, is this all the DVDs you've made over the last year?
It is.
26,000 DVDs. They're last year's ones. Don't worry about them.
Look, Giles,
machine,
you're
I love it.
Giles is on there, yeah.
Great, made it. You can follow me at Giles Olson. Robbie, where can people follow you?
You know where, Giles, just Robbie McKay.
I know where. It's just weird now. You can follow the Filmmakers Pod at Filmmakers Pod, obviously. And if you want to come on the podcast, if you've got a film released recently or you've got a friend who has, then do get in touch. TheFilmmakersPodcast@gmail.com, and it could happen to you. You could have the glory and the fandom and the famedom of being on the Filmmakers Podcast. But if you've got a shout out you want to do, or you've got a Kickstarter, let us know and we'll give it a shout out for you as well. Thank you so much. Join us next week when we have the director and screenwriter Andre Overdahl. You'll know him from the fantastic movies Troll Hunter, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, who joins us to talk about his brand new movie Mortal. Don't miss that. That's next week's episode, next Tuesday, with Andre Overdahl. Remember, you can go make your indie film. You can do it. Be prepared and go out there and rise up. And if you do, then you have to send the elevator back down. But anyway, I am now going to go to Colchester, sit myself down in a car park and wait for the cold coffee to arrive. Ben Mole, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great time.
Lucinda, really, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Cheers, everyone. Take care.
Bye, guys. Bye, Robbie. Bye, Charles. Bye.